Here on Gadget Lab, we dive deep into the tech universe, tackling questions like, is giving companies access to your genetic material a good idea? And are the latest phone releases really that different than the last ones? We want to help you make informed decisions about what is worth your attention. And here's something that is undeniably worth your time, a digital subscription to Wired. Lucky for you, we are giving Gadget Lab listeners an exclusive discount, 20% off an annual subscription to Wired. Just visit wired.com and use the promo code GL20 to get 20% off a digital subscription. Use GL20 to get exclusive access to stories on the latest innovations like AI, deepfakes, and VR, as well as today's most talked about people in technology.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Mike.
Lauren.
Have you ever been hacked?
I don't think so. Like, I haven't been outright hacked, but I'm also not certain that all of my devices are uncompromised at this point.
You have a lot of smart home gadgets.
I do, yeah. A lot of like little things that are connected to the internet that I never really check in on. So I don't know, maybe I have been.
And we spend all day on the internet using like 200 apps.
Yes. Oh God, all the apps. Okay, so yeah, maybe I have. I don't know why.
Have you read Andy Greenberg's latest story in Wired?
Yes, I have.
It's epic.
It really is.
It's this incredible tale of these three teenage hackers, well, they were teenagers at the time, who basically took down the internet for one day in 2016. But the tale of how they got there, like where they started and where they ended up, it blew my mind. And actually, it made me feel like worried about all my stuffs on the internet.
Yes, we should all be worried.
We should. And we have Andy on the show today to tell us more about this story.
I can't wait.
So let's talk about it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Gadget Lab. I'm Lauren Good. I'm a senior writer at Wired.
And I'm Michael Calori. I'm a senior editor at Wired.
And we're joined this week by Wired senior writer Andy Greenberg, he of all the hack stories. Andy, welcome back on the show. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
So, Andy, we've brought you on because Wired has just published your massive epic of a feature story titled The Mirai Confessions, Three Young Hackers Who Built a Web-Killing Monster Finally Tell Their Story. It's the story of the hackers who created a malware tool called Mirai that took down some of the biggest websites back in 2016, including Netflix, Spotify, Twitter, PayPal, Slack, everything. It was a massive cyber attack that rocked the foundations of the internet. And now, for the first time, the people who created that malware have told their story to you. So, Andy, we wanted to talk about the specific tools that these hackers used, and then later in the show, we'll talk about how it all came tumbling down. But first, how did you get in contact with these guys? What made them finally want to tell their story?
Well, you know, it's one of these like strange kind of winding, like one person leads you to the next things that happens when you've been covering this beat for, I don't know, 15 years or whatever I've been doing. So Marcus Hutchins, who I wrote a cover story about, another former teen hacker who went down a kind of rabbit hole of cybercrime and then redeemed himself in a sense by stopping the worst cyber attack in history at the time with this other massive cyber attack called WannaCry. Anyway, I won't retell his story, but he kind of put me in touch with, weirdly, not these hackers, but the FBI agent who tracked them down. Because Marcus, you know, has turned into a white hat hacker. He was part of this working group of security researchers who are trying to stop massive cyber attacks. And so he knows this FBI agent in Alaska named Elliot Peterson, who wanted to talk to me about, you know, the kind of work of this research group, which I, you know, I was kind of interested in. But then I found out that Elliot, this Alaskan FBI agent, was the one who tracked down these three young hackers who had created Mirai, this, by some measures, the biggest botnet in history responsible for these massive cyber attacks that were kind of like, where were you when that happened moments in cybersecurity for really everybody in this field. And when I found that out, not only that he was the one who had done that investigation, but that, kind of to spoil the ending here, that he had found these guys, flipped them one by one, turned them into essentially FBI informants, and then made them kind of like his own internal research team at the FBI, that as part of their sentence, they had worked for him for 5 years, and that those 5 years were about to be up. I kind of, wheedled my way into introductions to all three of these guys and started trying to convince them to tell this kind of, you know, epic and very twisty story of how they had themselves become cyber criminals, how they built this massive monster, how they lost control of it, and then how they ultimately ended up working for the FBI.
Hold on one second. Oh, I'm sorry. I think that's Hollywood knocking. Should we let them in?
You know, I wish it were that easy. This is ultimately a story that like takes place on the internet, which I find that, you know, screenwriters have a tough time with. But if you know anybody who is like really good at, depictions of like some sort of metaverse where, you know, all this drama happens online, then yeah, please let me know.
Well, previously on this podcast, Mike has recommended an entire Criterion movie selection of films just about people playing around on the internet.
Yeah, the techno
thrillers.
So it is
possible. It is possible, but let's put a pin in that and come back to it.
Andy, I think we need to do a little bit of background here before we dive into the particulars of the attack, because the thing that the Mirai code is known for is DDoS attacks. Can you briefly explain for our listeners who may not know what a DDoS attack is, what it is, how it works?
So DDoS stands for distributed denial of service. And it's actually like a very simple idea, which is that if you send enough junk traffic at any computer on the internet, you can basically kind of cause a traffic jam that knocks that computer offline. And it turns out that, you know, one way to do this is to the distributed part of this, really, and the distributed denial of service is that if you can hack, you know, hundreds of thousands of computers around the world, and then use them as a kind of zombie horde, you know, what we call a botnet, like a network of bots, then you can aim their junk traffic at any target you want and launch one of these DDoS attacks that just floods any server, any website, sometimes, you know, even like an individual's internet connection with this massive tsunami of junk traffic that they just cannot defend against. And they're suddenly knocked offline, that sometimes can be held offline for days on end. In fact, this is like, you know, this is a kind of eternal problem of the internet. It's not one that I was kind of hesitant to tell a big story about this because it's such an old and simple kind of attack. But it was interesting to me in part because it is just so fundamental. Like, it is just kind of unsolvable. It still persists today. And companies spend millions and millions of dollars to try to protect themselves from these attacks. It's like this kind of constant tax on the internet.
And I think the thing that set the Mirai attack apart was that this botnet that these three individuals built was not just other people's computers. It was not just, you know, dormant computers or servers out there on the internet. They tapped into the Internet of Things, right?
So, the real innovation of these three very young hackers, I mean, who were really teenagers when they started going down this rabbit hole, and only 19 and 20 when they caused their biggest cyber attacks, their big, you know, invention was to not just hack PCs or servers, but to look at these, you know, this whole kind of menagerie of internet connected devices, many of which were super vulnerable, it turns out, and kind of, enslave all of them as part of this Mirai botnet. That is how they amassed such a huge collection of zombie devices, and how they were able to launch such giant floods of traffic by, you know, hacking light bulbs and smart toasters and refrigerators and routers, but and actually the most powerful of all, it turns out, were the digital video recorders for security camera systems. DVRs have like a lot of processing power, and there's a ton of them out there. They're really insecure, and those were along with routers, home routers, were some of the most powerful kind of conscripts into this botnet.
Mike, I think you should be concerned about your smart home gadgets. Andy, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about these hackers' personalities. What was driving them or motivating them to do this? And I'm also wondering at what point maybe they started to realize that they were doing some harm, right? Because initially it seemed like they were kind of convinced they weren't really hurting anybody. And then things got more intense. At one point, one of them was swatted by a rival hacker. At another time, one of them took down the Rutgers University network so hard that some Rutgers students started to demand tuition refunds. So at what point would you say these guys actually started to realize what they were doing was perhaps harmful?
Right. Well, this is like the part of the story that really got me excited about telling it. I mean, to be honest, my colleague Lily Hay Newman had covered the Mirai attacks as news when they happened. And even another Wired writer, Garrett Graff, had done some stories more from like law enforcement's perspective about this investigation. So this was just the first time that I had, that anybody had gotten these three guys to talk and to tell their stories. And, those turned out to be just kind of wonderful, fascinating, kind of tragic, but kind of inspiring personal stories ultimately. But they, each one of them was kind of such an unlikely cyber criminal. Josiah White, who in some ways is like the primary inventor of some of these Internet of Things hacking techniques. He was a homeschooled Christian kid who worked in his family's computer repair shop in Pennsylvania and just kind of like took, one tiny step at a time. Convincing himself always that what he was doing was just kind of messing around, that it was victimless, that he was just a kind of Steve Wozniak kind of figure, but then like a boiling frog, just kind of slowly finding himself deeper and deeper into like a truly kind of disruptive and dangerous form of cybercrime. And his kind of like first accomplice, I guess, was this other kid, Dalton Norman, who had a much more tragic story. He had a debilitating stutter and that he thought would prevent him from having a normal life. He told himself yes, you're like super talented at this stuff, but you'll never be able to have a normal job in tech because you cannot even say your own name in a job interview. So this black hat cybercrime thing is your only hope of survival in the world. That's like what his teen brain was telling him. And he was also displaced by Hurricane Katrina. He was from New Orleans and kind of just struggled as a teenager to find his footing and ended up sinking deeper and deeper into this world of for-profit, hacking. And then the third of them was Paras Jha, who was the son of Indian immigrants and incredibly talented at coding, but had really, his parents, I think just coming from a culture that sort of stigmatized neurodivergence, kind of refused to acknowledge that he had really severe ADHD, it seems like. And he ended up kind of himself getting increasingly disillusioned and isolated and depressed, I think, until in college he was just DDoSing the Rutgers network to try to delay exams he started out because he wanted to register for computer science classes and the seniors and juniors were taking all of the spots. So he would try to DDoS the enrollment system until it was his turn so that he could get into the computer science classes he wanted. But he was just so alienated from his surroundings and had no social life. And this is how these three kids who ultimately, are all, I think it's fair to say they are like good people, if there is even such a distinction. I think in some sense, all people are good fundamentally, but this is like how they ended up building this monster and doing such damage, despite being like kids who came from loving families and are just kind of normal American kids.
So shortly after these three teamed up, they actually had the idea of legitimizing their services, right? By starting a company together.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's part of this kind of like stepwise, just incremental, bit by bit slide that they took into the biggest cyber crimes of their kind ever. And that was that Paras and Josiah decided that they were going to create a cybersecurity firm, like to defend against the kind of cyber attacks that they were, you know, increasingly becoming really talented at launching. They thought
that's called a protection racket.
Well, it wasn't at first. You know, they thought that they could actually just sell protection, real protection services. But then when they couldn't get any customers, you know, it turns out people don't really shop around for these things until they have to. They decided, oh, well, maybe we can, you know, create some of those situations where they have to by, you know, hitting off, as they put it, some of the customers of their competitors and then, you know, calling them up to sell their own services.
The timing was uncanny.
Yeah, I think that it didn't work out in part because it was a little suspicious to get a call from this like very young salesman for, you know, this company selling a service that you need at the moment that you've just been, you know, had your network destroyed by a well-timed cyber attack. So it didn't entirely work out. They found that that wasn't enough to keep their business alive. And so they turned to this even kind of, you know, more criminal step of just building this massive botnet to sell cyber attacks as a service. Even then, initially thinking, oh, we'll just make some money just to keep our defense business alive. But soon found that that was just too fun, too seductive, too, well, in some ways too profitable, although they didn't actually make that much money. And they just, you know, fell headlong into this kind of, you know, addictive feeling of launching these massive DDoS attacks on a scale that nobody had ever seen before.
And at one point, one of the hackers said to another, "This is illegal, right?" And the other said, "Kinda."
An understatement.
Yes. We're going to talk more about that in the second half of the show.
This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Each episode features insight you won't find anywhere else from the center of the conversation surrounding emerging technologies like AI. Right now on the podcast, you can hear a special episode where Brad Smith lays out Microsoft's vision for a vibrant marketplace driving the new AI economy. To hear more, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hackers and cybercriminals have always held this kind of special fascination.
Obviously, I can't tell you too much about what I do.
It's a game. Who's the best hacker? And I was like, well, this is child's play.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston. And on the Click Here podcast, you'll meet them and the people trying to stop them.
We're not afraid of the attack. We're afraid of the creativity and the intelligence of the human being behind it.
Click Here. Stories about the people making and breaking our digital world.
AI machine.
Satellite. Engine ignition.
Click here.
And liftoff.
Click here every Tuesday and Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Andy, tell us how the hackers' attacks started to escalate and then how it all started to unravel.
Right. Well, once these three guys had created Mirai, they put it up for sale, basically. They started, or rather rents, really. You could rent time with this botnet to launch attacks on anybody you wanted to. And very quickly, you know, people were taking down massive, like, Minecraft services. They were attacking the Rio Olympics that were taking place that summer of 2016. But then the big one that really got everyone's attention was when one of, you know, their customers started launching cyber attacks at Brian Krebs, this very well-known independent cybersecurity reporter. And, you know, that is like not a good idea. Brian is really well-known for kind of vengefully chasing down hackers and doxing them, like revealing their identities. And sure enough, like, well, his website was taken offline for multiple days, which was shocking. I mean, it wasn't actually the biggest cyber attack of its kind that anybody had ever seen, but it seemed like it because it was so high profile. Nobody really noticed some of the other ones that were even bigger, like a full.
Right. Like, people are like, PayPal, psh, Brian Krebs.
Well, they were hitting off attention. Like, it was more like, you know, some Minecraft server I've never heard of, like nobody's paying attention. Even the Rio attacks were somehow defended against and did not actually take anything down, despite being pretty big. Like this French hosting company, OVH, was hit with a terabit a second of DDoS, which, I don't know, it's hard to even kind of grapple with the size of that, but it is, you know, hundreds of times bigger than very large attacks that people were used to at the time. So then Brian Krebs was hit with an attack about half that size, which still seemed like just unbelievable. And there was no way that he could defend himself. I mean, his site was truly just torn offline for 4 days. So that was really like a kind of poking the bear moment. And, you know, soon after that, the FBI was on their trail when, you know, these three guys started to get the sense that an FBI agent, Elliot Peterson, this Alaskan FBI agent, was looking into them. They kind of panicked, and one of them decided that as a kind of like smoke bomb distraction, he would release the source code for their botnet as a way to kind of just like muddy the waters, make it possible for anybody to create a Mirai bot. He thought, like, you know, who was the original Mirai? It would be like some kind of I Am Spartacus moment. But of course, what that really did was just unleash incredible chaos across the internet. Just like, instead of one kind of massive out of control botnet, there were now just countless ones, including one that within 3 weeks would launch this particular cyber attack that was, you know, the big one, essentially, that would take down a massive chunk of the internet for the entire United States.
Yes, tell us about the big one. We remember it because we were working here, and as you mentioned, we were writing about it, and I'm sure some of our listeners might remember it. But talk through what happened on that day.
Well, right. I mean, Wired, in fact, was taken down by this attack, too. I'm not sure we were aware of that at the time, but like nobody on the East Coast of the U.S. for a little while could actually reach Wired.com. So this attack, which happened in October of 2016, really just weeks before the 2016 election, and that's part of what created this feeling of like, oh my God, this is the big one. It has to be the Russians. This is like a practice run for the attack on Election Day. But really, it was actually just some hacker who was using one of these copycat Mirai botnets to attack the PlayStation Network. But they went after the PlayStation Network's DNS service. And DNS is, you know, sorry to like have to define another thing, but it's like the domain name system. It's kind of like the directory system for the internet. It's how domain names like google.com get translated into IP addresses so that you can just type a name into your web browser instead of like a long string of numbers. And basically, by going after this PlayStation DNS service, they actually probably accidentally took down this whole DNS company, Dyn, that provides DNS for 175,000 websites for users across the United States, and essentially broke the internet for millions and millions and millions of users.
And how long was the internet broken for?
This really lasted for just half a day, but that's a long time for 175,000 websites to be offline. And I did even talk to people inside of Dyn, this DNS company, about what this felt like. And it was just, you know, total chaos. It also happened to be on the very day that Dyn was signing off on a deal to be acquired by Oracle for $600 million. And there was just absolute panic within the company of like, nobody wanted to be the middle manager responsible for the entire internet going down on the day that the new bosses were watching. And it was just like absolutely this cascading, it was almost like a DDoS attack inside the company, as one staffer described it to me, like with managers just kind of flooding their subordinates with requests for information about what was happening, and nobody had any answers. And that just led to this feeling of absolute pandemonium inside the company.
I wonder who's going to play the middle manager in the Hollywood version of this story. Who's like, maybe it's like their first week on the job.
Jason Segel.
Yeah. Rami Malek. Okay.
Oh, those are very handsome middle managers. I was thinking more like Steve Buscemi or something.
Okay. So you've mentioned this Alaskan FBI agent, Elliot Peterson, who was sort of on their tail at this point. There was also a security researcher, Allison Nixon, who around 2014 became aware of the hacker called Lightspeed, though she didn't know his real name at the time. She started digging deep into hack forums. How did researchers and agents eventually catch up with these guys?
Well, they didn't make it easy. I mean, they were actually, as was described to me by, you know, the FBI and by other researchers, they were pretty sophisticated about covering their tracks, but they did make some mistakes. So Josiah, at one point, for instance, like used his own IP address to scan the internet in the same way that Mirai did, which was the first thing that led Elliot Peterson to him to start asking him questions. And then it turned out that Paras had actually created this burner account on one of the hacker forums that he would use to kind of cheerlead for himself under a different name, and then also to take swipes at critics of Mirai. And Elliot Peterson very cleverly figured out that that probably was him, and then started actually got the email address for that account and subpoenaed Google and found out that it was the same IP address as that he was using for something else. And so there turned out to be a kind of trail of breadcrumbs that led to these guys. And then Elliot Peterson, you know, by following those few clues, was able to start flipping them one by one and turning them against one another in this kind of web of betrayal and paranoia.
Oh, I like that. Who plays Elliot Peterson? Sterling K. Brown.
Don't know who that is.
Neither do I, but it's a great FBI sounding kind of name.
So speaking of Elliot Peterson, one of my favorite details in this story was the fact that he's this FBI agent in Alaska. And in order for him to make this a case that he can work on, he has to determine that they've compromised a computer in Alaska. So he starts looking at all of the places that the botnet has spread. And he's like, oh, it's actually like several thousand devices here in Alaska, so this should be easy. When I got to that part of the story, I started looking around my house, and I was looking at like the security camera that's on the side of my house, my Eero, my light bulbs, my Sonos speakers, my Apple TV. And I kept thinking like, okay, all of these things are probably at some part of a botnet. And then later that night, I was watching something on HBO, and I was streaming, and the picture quality started to degrade. And I said to myself, this is it. My Apple TV is being used as part of a distributed denial of service attack. And here I am like participating in it right in front of my face. So it really got me thinking, like, is all of our stuff compromised? Should we actually be paranoid about this as users of Internet of Things devices? Should we worry that we are contributing to the internet crashing?
Well, I think it's smart to worry. I do think that it's important to remember that Mirai was a kind of like peak moment in this insecurity of the Internet of Things that happened in late 2016. And I do think it served as a kind of wake up call to the whole tech industry that you can't just start pumping out all of this internet connected crap without consequences. That even if like, the consequences of your smart light bulbs being insecure are not that serious for your customers, they contribute to this kind of just pollution of hackable detritus out there that can be wrapped up into these massive cyber attacks. And I think that things, I don't know, I may be speaking out of turn, but I feel like things have gotten more secure. I don't imagine your Apple TV is vulnerable to some of the like sometimes very simple exploits that these guys were using. I mean, they were hacking a lot of these devices with truly just sort of username admin, password admin kind of vulnerabilities that exist in a lot of the sort of not brand name, but very cheap and very numerous Internet of Things devices that were out there at the time. Probably many of them are out there today. So I think things have gotten better, but I do think that yes, like you should be thinking about what in your home you have connected to the internet. You should be setting passwords on those, like changing the default passwords on them. You should be updating them. I mean, if you have like an internet connected fridge, when was the last time you thought about updating it? Not to mention your home router, you know?
Mm-hmm. Not to mention, why did you buy an internet connected fridge in the first place?
Not to mention, why does everything have to be internet connected?
Well, I felt bad saying that on this, you know, on the Gadget Lab podcast, but truly,
okay.
I don't
we keep it real here.
I don't, you know, truly want any of my stuff other than my computer and my phone to be connected to the internet. I have two kids. I've never bought an internet connected baby monitor, for instance. I'm terrified of this stuff. And it's really just because it's very hard to know that it's secure. Not only could it become a zombie in one of these botnets, but that it could be used against you in your own home too. So yeah, I feel like just keep it analog when you can. Why or at least offline digital.
Aside from the Internet of Things, I mean, what would you say is the part of internet hygiene that consumers should be just most cautious around, knowing that there are hackers who live on these hacker forums and are just constantly like trying to poke holes in the internet and our gadgets when they can.
Well, I think if you look at what these three guys did, you know, they were not, it's interesting because, you know, most of the hackers that I write about, like who are the most sophisticated, the most interesting, are going after a specific target. Like if they want to cause like a blackout in a Ukrainian electrical utility, they have a kind of relatively hard target, and they spend like a year finding a vulnerability, finding a way to spread their access, finding a way to like get from the IT side of the network, do the part where you can like start turning off circuit breakers. That is not what these guys were doing. They were scanning the whole internet and looking for really simple vulnerabilities and just trying to, you know, do this at scale. And I think that to protect yourself from the first kind of hacker I was talking about is almost impossible. To protect yourself from the second is actually pretty easy. You know, it is like a matter of like just not outrunning the bear, but outrunning the guy next to you. And that means just, yeah, like setting strong passwords, using a password manager, using two-factor authentication, updating your devices, all the boring stuff that we do write about like periodically in the security section at Wired. You know, these kind of like eat your vegetables and brush your teeth kind of prevention methods.
Yeah, password managers are hugely important. Like I've had conversations on dates where I'm like, you're not using a password manager? How are you not using a password manager? We need to talk about this. It's really scintillating stuff. It's true. And we've written guides to password managers here at Wired too. That's really good advice, Andy.
You also just limit your attack surface is another principle in cybersecurity. And that means, yes, like not connecting your fridge to the internet if you don't need to, you know, and I don't know, not connecting your security cameras with that DVR that's like such a powerful piece of a botnet. And if everybody did kind of follow these principles, I feel like there would be a lot less ammunition out there for this kind of DDoS-focused hacker too.
Well, Andy, your story is epic. There's so much in there that we couldn't possibly cover on this podcast. So for folks who are interested in learning more about how the hackers were eventually caught, how they were turned on each other, what happened next, what they're doing now, all of that, please go read Andy's story, or you can pick up a copy of Wired. It's the cover story this month. Andy, stick around, because when we come back, we're going to do our weekly recommendations.
Hey, everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode of the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
Andy, as our guest of honor, you get to go first. What's your recommendation this week?
Well, I will recommend my friend Kashmir Hill's book. She's a New York Times reporter, and she's written this book, Your Face Belongs to Us, which is about AI and facial recognition. And it's specifically the story of her investigation into Clearview AI, this kind of very dystopian startup that created the ability to kind of like do a Google search or a Shazam style search on anyone's face and you know, find their identity based on just what they look like, which is, you know, a really simple sounding tool that kind of disassembles all of our ideas about privacy. And it's really just a kind of wonderful detective story that she tells of incredibly impressive reporting, but also this kind of parable about what happens when dystopian tech falls into the hands of people who are just willing to take it to its limits.
What was the thing about Cash's book that surprised you most?
The thing that I really didn't know that was in some ways like most interesting was that Clearview AI did not really like come up with a technological breakthrough to be able to do this like very disturbing kind of facial recognition, that actually Facebook and Google had these abilities and made the choice not to develop or release those tools. As Kashmir says, this was not a technological breakthrough. It was an ethical breakthrough, or a kind of unethical breakthrough, that just kind of shows like the importance in the history of technology of just somebody being willing to cross the line, which is exactly, you know, what this startup did.
That is a great recommendation. I have Cash's book on my list. I can't wait to read it. Thanks, Andy. Mike, what's your recommendation?
Okay. So I'm going to recommend that if you're the type of person who celebrates the upcoming holidays by getting a tree and decorating the tree, I'm going to recommend that you not do that. And instead, you get a fancy wreath.
Say more.
Okay. So there's no reason to cut down a tree. I mean, don't cut down the trees. The trees are beautiful things and they grow out of the ground. And then right when they're just like, you know, just about to become adults, we cut them down and we put them in our homes. And then they end up as like sad garbage in early January on our front lawns and our stoops. So let's not do that, people. Let's use the branches that come off the tree, but keep the tree alive and make a wreath, because wreaths are much more easy to manage. They're easier to care for than a tree. They are beautiful. You can put them on the outside of your house if you want, so that people walking by can see them. They're much more versatile than trees. I enjoy a beautiful wreath. It smells just as good as a tree smells. Also, you don't have to use a plant wreath. You can use a designer wreath, like a reusable wreath. Mm-hmm. There are really nice, like artsy wreaths that you can get at the various, you know, Christmas stores or holiday stores that are popping up right now. So this is my recommendation, that, like, you know, trees are from like your childhood and that was cool and everything. But if you're going to do the Christmas thing, get a wreath instead.
Well, wait. If you take away the trees, then they're not going to be a part of other people's childhoods. You're just like stopping the childhood tree.
Right. And instead introducing something that is vastly superior, which is the wreath.
This is a tough one. I do love a good Christmas tree. Fortunately, I travel for Christmas. So I'm wholly dependent on the people who I travel to get the tree. I don't do the tree.
Right.
But maybe a eco-friendly solution is just to gather as many people as possible around your tree each year. So like 20 people celebrate one tree instead of like groups of four or five each having a tree.
Yes.
I don't know. Really? You're ending Christmas trees? We're probably going to get like, there's going to be some political campaign against the Gadget Lab because you're canceling Christmas trees.
That's fine. I can handle it. All I'm saying is that wreaths and garlands, I should not leave garlands out of the conversation, they're better all around from like an ethical standpoint and just from an aesthetic standpoint. You know, like it's weird to walk into your house and just see this giant dead tree just sitting there with all this stuff hanging off of it. They can also be fire hazards. Wreaths are where it's at, people.
I don't know the difference between a wreath and a garland, but maybe you can just put like some links in the show notes.
or I can just very quickly say that a garland is a long...
It's like a scarf.
Yeah, it's like a scarf that you put on your banister.
On your mantle.
Of course.
It's green. Yeah. It's pine, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Whereas a wreath is a decorative arrangement, usually in a circle, and it can be any size. It can be the size of a human. It can be the size of a small human. It can be the size of a cat.
All right, Mike, thank you. Thank you, ? For that recommendation.
You're welcome, ! What is your recommendation?
My recommendation this week is sweet potato hoppia pie bars.
Okay.
Those of you who follow me on Instagram know that I had a little bit of a failed baking experiment this past weekend, but I was in Hawaii recently. It was a short trip, and during that time, I had these incredible, incredible sweet potato bars for breakfast. Got them from a local coffee shop there, came home and decided that I wanted to try to replicate it. I did find a recipe, which I will link to in the show notes. I have not successfully replicated this recipe yet. Not a super good baker. But these are incredible. So they use Okinawan sweet potatoes, purple sweet potatoes. You boil them, mash it up, puree it. You can use a different kind of crust. You can use shortbread crust, graham cracker crust, pie crust. But then you pour in the filling. And then I think the hoppia, which is the creamy coconut topping, is really what makes it. It's just delectable. It's so delicious.
So you make this in like a sheet pan?
You can make it in a sheet pan. You can make it in a round pie plate. You can, I mean, you could probably make it as like a little individual cupcake bars. So, I don't know. I didn't try that, but.
So the ones I've seen, they come out, they sort of look like, yeah, they look like a lemon bar, except yes. The lemony part is purple.
That's exactly right. Okay. That's exactly right. And the top is coconut, is creamy coconut. I mean, and some people put some macadamia nuts on them. This was so incredible. Like, of course, I had it for breakfast and I was like, this is the best breakfast bar ever. And then I realized it's just dessert.
Yes.
Being served at 8 in the morning. So
I want two of them right now.
But sweet potatoes are very good for you. So that's.
Yeah, especially when you put a bunch of butter and sugar in them.
Cream and butter and sugar. Yeah, I'm sorry to say, Mike, these are probably make them vegan. The ones that I attempted to make were not vegan.
Thank you for pointing
out. I have to keep working on this recipe, but what a life changer. Highly recommend this recipe. Yeah. So if you want to be that person who shows up at your friends' holiday parties and, you know, point at their tree and call them out for having a tree, you can make it all better by saying, but you should try these sweet potato hopia pie bars that I made.
Thank you.
You're welcome! Exclamation point. All right, that's our show. Andy, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you on the Gadget Lab, and we need to have you back on again soon. So I guess get cracking on the next hack.
I'll be working on it. Thank you both for having me.
And thank you, Mike, as always, for being a great co-host.
Of course. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. If you have feedback, you can find all of us on the socials. Just check the show notes. Our producer is the excellent Boone Ashworth, who is not a hacker, as far as we know. Goodbye for now. We'll be back next week.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.